11th, 2012. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN, for people who can handle the truth. RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1@yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna@spingola.com, which I do not access during the program. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Peter Eichstadt. His websites are petereichstadt.com. The spelling of that last name is E-I-C-H-S-T-A-E-D-T. His other website is petereichstadt.blogspot.com. He is the author of several amazing books. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Well, thank you for having me.
Am I pronouncing your last name properly?
Yeah, that's good. Eichstadt, Eichsted. It's, most people just avoid it and call me Mr. Peter.
That's good. That's easy, right?
That's easy, yes.
Okay, your books. I have two of your books. I have the Kindle edition of Consuming the Congo, War and Conflict Minerals and the World's Deadliest Place, and that came out in 2011. I also have If You Poison Us, Uranium and Native Americans, which came out in 1994. You've also written Pirate State, Inside Somalia's Terrorism at Sea in 2010. And you have two books coming out next year, both in April.
Yes, I have a... I also wrote my first book about Africa, which was about child soldiers in East Africa, called First Kill Your Family.
Oh, right, right. Yes, I was getting to that one.
Okay.
All righty. But is that coming out as a newer version in April, on April 1st?
Oh, yeah, that's what you're referring to. It's coming out in paperback edition.
Okay.
And then... And then the new book is called Above the Din of War, and it's about my experiences in Afghanistan from 2010 and 2011, which was the second year of my life I'd spent there.
Okay. I imagine that was very interesting. We have had people on the program who are from Afghanistan and who go back there on a periodic basis and to try to help. But you mentioned a book that is going to be redone in the hard copy, First Kill Your Family.
Yes, yeah.
And you originally published that when?
Yeah, that came out in 2009, and it was a result of a year's worth of work I did in Uganda, and I've been able to travel around the world and work and write a lot of these books because of my employment with an interesting organization based in London that's called the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. And what we do is we go into basically war zones and post-war zones, post-conflict zones, they're called. And we work with journalists and help them expand and improve their skills. And this involves a whole wide range of projects.
Peter, I hate to interrupt, but we do have to take a real quick break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Today is Peter Eichstadt. His websites are petereichstadt.com and petereichstadt.blogspot.com. And Peter, you were telling us about the group that you work with that allows you to travel about and interview some very interesting people and find out what's going on in other parts of the world. And then you're sharing your experiences with us.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's called the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and what led to my first book about Africa was a project we operated in Uganda, which is in Eastern Africa, and it's known it's well known as the Pearl of Africa, and it's a very beautiful country, relatively small. It's adjacent to Rwanda, and it also borders with the Democratic Republic of the Congo on the west, and then the Sudan, or what's now South Sudan, on the north, and then Kenya to the east. And and that's where I came across this, which I was shocked to learn about this war, rebel war that had been going on in Uganda for 20 years. And at the time, it had claimed approximately 100,000 people's lives, and I was aghast that so little was known about this war and about the rebel army, and so that set me off on a project that resulted in the book called First Kill Your Family, and. What I learned was the war was being perpetrated by an organization, an army called the Lord's Resistance Army, and they survived primarily by attacking villages across and around northern Uganda and southern Sudan, and kidnapping young boys and girls and forcing them to join their army, and. They would be able to do this because they take these kids at these children at gunpoint and force them to kill their friends or even members of their family. And once either that or be killed themselves. So once they were once they would do that, then these young boys and girls were mentally traumatized, obviously, and. Could then be much more easily manipulated and forced to commit other atrocities. And it was a pretty terrible problem. And I was, at first, I was skeptical that I would be able to do a book about it because, this war had been going on for 20 years and had gotten some press coverage, but not a lot. And it was one of these seeming tragedies that was going to continue to go on, and well under the international radar, indefinitely. And however, I made some proposals, and I contacted some people in the publishing world, and I was able, with some help, to find a publisher actually right there in Chicago, and publishing company called Chicago Review Press. They were more than happy to pick up, do the book and take a chance. And I was ecstatic, of course, and I felt that this was what I was able to do was to call some attention to this very, very serious problem.
Right. Now, who is funding these people that are perpetuating this war?
Well, it's actually not a funded by any particular group. The way this rebel army has been operating is that they operate as they roam around the region and they just steal and loot and take whatever they want. And for quite a while, from 1986 until 2006, which was a full 20 years, they were supported by Sudan, the Sudanese government. And the reason they were doing this was because, they were following this old axiom that, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And at the time, there's been a long-standing, civil war took place in Sudan, which just recently resulted in South Sudan becoming its own separate country. Well, while this war was going on between Sudan and South Sudan, South Sudan was being supported by Uganda at the time. And since this rebel army was fighting the Ugandan government, Sudan decided they could would cause as much trouble as possible for Uganda by supporting this rebel army and in northern Uganda, which they did. And this rebel army, they also used it a little bit to fight the South Sudanese rebels on occasion. So it was kind of a complicated mess, you know, with various players. And I know, too, you know, most Americans, most outsiders coming into a situation like that, it's difficult to sort out who's who. But it was a complicated mess. And to answer your question specifically, Sudan was supporting these people for a long time, and that allowed them to continue to fight. And you know, by the time I got there, which was in 2005 and 2006, the rebel army had in fact been pretty well weakened, and to the point that they. And part of this was due to pressure that was brought by the United States against the Sudan government. They, you know, the rebel army was crippled to the point where they finally agreed to begin peace talks. And so part of my, a number of chapters of my book is has to do with the peace talks and the experiences I had making contact with the rebel army, the Lord's Resistance Army, and you know, talking with some of the people that were involved with the army about why they were doing, I mean, who they were and why they were doing what they were doing.
Was it about the resources in the region? I know they're very resource rich.
Well, you know, ultimately, I mean, specifically for the Lord's Resistance Army, it's not about resources, but resources do come into play in the region. And South Sudan, as you know, has significant oil reserves, which is the primary reason between the primary reason that Sudan and South Sudan were fighting. As you know, South Sudan is a Christian country, and Sudan itself is Muslim. So there was a kind of a tug of war between these two groups as to who is going to control the oil resources in South Sudan, and that fomented the war there. And this rebel army was kind of part of the mix, although they didn't really stand to gain anything per se, you know, because of you know, what was curious to me, which is what you're driving at, as to why, you know, why would a rebel army that conscripts children, you know, why would they continue doing what they've been doing? And I struggled to answer that question, and the only answer that I can provide is that they their mission initially had been to try to topple the Ugandan government, but since they were never able to do that, they became so ingrained in their lifestyle of self-perpetuating them themselves by attacking and attacking villages and stealing and looting and killing, that became their reason for existence.
Right.
And now the government, or ironically, the rebel army has been chased out of northern Uganda, is now in roaming around the region to the west. It's in an area of Central Africa where South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and the Central African Republic meet. And the army is very much alive and well and continues to do the same thing, which is simply loot in order to survive.
Well, there were some implications in the book Blood Diamond, also in the movie, about the seizure of children and having them go through these horrible experiences and having them actually kill their family. It is just amazing to me that that these children survive at all, and a lot of them don't. They get killed, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredibly traumatizing, and it, one of the things that I've seen in my especially traveling around the country and giving readings and lectures about this issue, is that a lot of people, it's difficult for Americans and it's difficult for Western Europeans to understand the psychology and the reason that organizations like the Lord's Resistance Army exist. And you have to adjust your perspective a little bit. Now, I'm not saying accept it, but which, of course, we don't or can't, but you have to adjust your way of looking at what happens. And a lot of it is, because of the immense and intense poverty that exists there.
Right.
It generates a whole different way of looking at life.
All righty, Peter, we are going to a break. We'll be right back on the other side. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Peter Eichstadt. His websites are petereichstadt.com and petereichstadt.blogspot.com. And the website for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting is IWPR.net. And you were talking about our perspectives and our perspective here in this country and in Western Europe, that we have no comprehension about the poverty or the situation that these people live in. And so it's very difficult for us to understand the desperate situation and why people do what they do.
Yeah, it's very difficult. We especially in America tend to live in I call it a luxury bubble, and we tend to look at the world through our own perspective, which of course is natural. But we live in a highly industrialized society. It's well organized. The government functions as it should, I'm making broad statements, of course, but the government functions. The post office works. The police, when a crime happens, the police will show up. The schools. You grow up as a child, and you fully expect to be able to go to school. You expect to come home to live in a house that's taken care of, and you expect to be able to eat. As you grow older, you expect to, we live in a world of computers. You expect to, I know my nieces and nephews, are already, computer literate by the time they're 8 and 9 years old. All of these things, none of these things exist, in these remote regions of Africa. There is, no health care. There are virtually no schools. There is no clean water. There is no employment. There is no expectation of anything beyond a subsistence existence. And when you live in circumstances like this, there's no computers. There's only until recently was mobile phone service available in much of these regions. And if you get beyond, and even still, if you get more than about 5 miles beyond these major metropolitan areas, there is no communication except for satellite phones. And, of course, people don't have satellite phones because it's so expensive. And and these kind of circumstances give rise to people who will, out of desperation, will do anything they can to survive. And once people get their hands on a gun or some kind of weapon, they're off and running. It's very easy to form an army.
Right.
A gang,
So this is really the epitome of a third world country, that where no structure exists, where the government is not functioning at all, if there is a government. It seems, and you mentioned gangs. It seems that the whole country is run by gangs and violence and murder and plundering and.
Yeah, well, that was one of the ironies about what I wrote about, and the ironies about the existence of the Lord's Resistance Army, is that Uganda is not that large a country. It's about the size of Oregon, but the whole northern part of the country was a war zone that it was because of this Lord's Resistance Army. And the great irony is that Uganda is considered one of the most advanced, and it is, in fact, one of the most advanced countries in Africa. The southern part of Uganda is very developed. It's very organized. The police and schools and government are all functioned. The capital of Kampala has one of the best hospitals in Eastern Africa. It's second only to Kenya as one of the best shining examples of a successful African country. Ironically, the northern part of the country when I was there in 2005 and 2006 was a virtual no man's land. And that's what was one of the impetus that I had to write this book, is that here in the midst of this seeming African success story was this terrible tragedy.
How did it get that way? Was there a particular thing? Was it?
Most people, I think, are familiar with former dictator Idi Amin. And Idi Amin was the subject of a fairly successful movie called The Last King of Scotland. And this Idi Amin was a maniacal dictator who took control of Uganda in the late 70s. And he was eventually defeated and driven out of the country by a man named Yoweri Museveni. And Museveni got some help from some surrounding countries and was able to topple Idi Amin. Well, he typically what happens in these situations is governments are changed by means of military coup. And he was able to ultimately defeat Amin and then take control of the government.
Okay. We are going to a break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Peter Eichstadt. His websites are petereichstadt.com and petereichstadt.blogspot.com. And you were talking about Amin and how they got rid of him, and
I'm talking about the origins of the Lord's Resistance Army, and I just to make it simple, it was like it after Idi Amin was toppled, the Uganda was plunged into a civil war that lasted about 5 years, and the defeated elements went north, and they continued to fight. And Museveni became president in 1986, and this is when the Lord's Resistance Army was formed. So for 20 years, they carried this, they continued this civil war, so to speak, on and off for 20 years, and that's what resulted in all the death and destruction up there. But the problem was, the real confusing aspect of this war was that the people who of northern Uganda were the ones that who had initially supported the, or were composed one side of the civil war, they ended up being the victims of the Lord's Resistance Army instead of supporting the Lord's Resistance Army. And because the people of the north became tired of civil war, they refused to. They didn't want the war to continue, and they refused to support what had become the continuation of the resistance against the Ugandan government, which was the Lord's Resistance Army. So the people in the north refused to support that rebel army. So instead of disbanding, the rebel army turned on the people that had initially supported it, and they began, stealing children, you know, boys and girls from the various villages, taking the food, you know, water. They would steal weapons, you know, whatever they needed to survive.
Right.
And that's how, you know, that was the origin of the Lord of Resistance Army. And it continued on. You know, it eventually drew, it gained support from Sudan, as I said, because Uganda was helping South Sudan in their civil war. So, anyway, you know, the army was able to exist and continue to exist and continue to commit atrocities for 20 years.
Right. Now, we know that foreign interests have a lot of influence in the area. They're, of course, interested ever since the Belgian Congo days when you had King Leopold down there with all his shenanigans, and other countries have gone into African countries to exploit the resources. Are there interests there that now currently that are benefited by all of this chaos?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. You know, one of the things, one of the points that I argue fairly strongly in my book, and I continue to argue, is that, you know, as I said, Uganda is one of the most advanced and the most developed countries in East Africa, and is used as an example of a success story. So I always wonder why, you know, why the Lord's Resistance Army could not be defeated by the Uganda government, since they had one of the best trained armies in Eastern Europe or Eastern Africa as well. And I had to come to the conclusion is that the existence of the Lord's Resistance Army was a real benefit to the Uganda government, because they were able to collect millions and millions of dollars worth of foreign aid to help them fight this army. And in reality, what I found out was that Uganda, while they were accepting and soliciting, you know, millions of dollars in aid, used the bulk of its forces to, instead of going after the Lord's Resistance Army, they went over to eastern provinces of the Democratic Republic of the Congo and began to help themselves to all of the mineral wealth in eastern Congo. So, in essence, what they were doing was using their war against the Lord's Resistance Army, this rebel army in northern Uganda, as a diversion for the international community, while they spent most of their time and the bulk of their forces were in eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. And there they were able to plunder... Well, timber was a big resource because it's such a heavily forested area, and that's one of the resources, but also huge amounts of gold and diamonds, which were taken from mines a little bit further to the north in East. But they essentially controlled, through their own direct occupation and also the development of some proxy militias and armies, pretty much the whole north, if you look at a map, the northeastern quadrant of the Democratic Republic of the Congo was controlled by Uganda, and it made them very, very rich.
Well, inasmuch as they were getting money from the West, you know, pretending to use it to fight this war, did that money buy some of those resources that the Ugandans were getting out of the Congo?
Well, what happened was that the when I was there in 2005 and 2006, and which I wrote about, was what was happening was that with all this foreign aid that was being given to Uganda, they used a very small amount of it to fight this Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda, conduct a civil war. And what they did is they would tell the international community that they had X number of fighters in the north, when in fact they had a fraction of those soldiers. So this money was being taken from the international community and given to the generals who were fighting supposed to be fighting this war. So what was happening is that the Ugandan government was using this money to pad the salaries and enrich the military elite. And meanwhile, instead of using these soldiers to fight in northern Uganda, they used them to fight in the Democratic Republic of the Congo to help them control the gold mines and diamond mines. And that's what...
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Were there any corporations, multinational corporations, that had interest in the area that would benefit from these generals? Were the generals working for the Ugandan government, or were they working for some multinationals? Or was money coming from the taxpayers? Of course, it could have been coming from the taxpayers with corporate benefits, right?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, the tax, you know, foreign aid comes from a variety of sources, but, of course, it's the largest source, of course, is taxpayer, U.S. taxes. So, but, you know, the problem, I mean, there are some multinational corporations that were, in fact, benefiting, and in particular, the gold mines in one of the largest gold mines in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo was in this town called Mungwalu, where I spent a couple of days interviewing people there. And the gold, the rights to the gold are in fact owned by a South African company, and it's an international gold production company. But what had actually happened is that the Ugandan government, in conjunction with the Rwandan government, and this was after the Rwandan genocide, they joined forces to help each other plunder the resources in Eastern Africa or Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, and they actually drove the African or the South African gold mining company out. And then they decided, the Ugandans took control of this large gold mine and began to plunder it themselves. And so there was a kind of what's called a Pan-African movement in play, in which the governments of Uganda or the people that control the governments in Uganda and Rwanda decided to help themselves to these resources instead of letting the profits of the resources be plundered by international corporations. But now, you know, this went on for quite a while, but in the last, I would say, last 10 years, certainly, this movement has kind of died down, and the riches have been taken to the extent that they've been wanted, and now countries like the Democratic Republic of the Congo are turning back again to international corporations for and letting them exploit the resources.
Right. Now, Israel has the world's biggest diamond market. So did they have some sort of interest in the international corporations that were active there?
Well, I didn't come across any interest in terms of diamonds by the Israelis per se. As my experience was that the raw diamonds, despite the fact that there's a large international agreement to regulate the flow of diamonds out of Africa and ensure that they're not blood diamonds, that there's a lot of different ways to get those diamonds out and get them certified, and a lot of certified as non-blood diamonds, and the certification process is being subverted by corruption, and if you can read that book, Blood Diamonds, you know, you can see how easily, that can happen. But of more interest to Uganda and Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is gold. And gold is a very important commodity there. And the gold, one of the interesting things is that Uganda is one of the largest exporters of gold from Africa. But the ironic thing is that Uganda has no gold mines.
Oh, really?
So what's happening is that the gold is being, you know, illegally taken out of these gold-rich regions of eastern Congo, and it's being smuggled across the border, and then it's legitimized and exported by legitimate exporting gold exporting companies, and it goes to places like Dubai initially. Dubai is a huge international gold market, and then from there, the gold is typically goes to countries such as Sweden or even not Sweden, but I mean Switzerland, which has a large gold industry. But from Dubai, it goes, you know, wherever people are buying it. Now the same is true with a similar kind of situation exists in Congo with diamonds, and a lot of these diamonds that are mined are legitimized by being smuggled out of the country, and then subsequently they get certified, and then they end up in places like Antwerp, Belgium, which is also one of the biggest diamond markets.
Right, it has been for some time.
Yeah, so it's despite international efforts to, you know, control and regulate the illegal exploitation of resources in the Congo and elsewhere, it's very difficult because the corruption is so pervasive.
And also because of the poverty, people are willing to work for their slave labor.
It's one of the things I witnessed personally was the complete willingness of people in eastern Congo to continue to work in these mines that produce all kinds of minerals, a wide variety of minerals, because they really have no other employment options, and they're willing to tolerate incredible level of abuse, including being forced to give significant portions of their proceeds to militias in order for the right to continue to work in these mines. Because, from their point of view, something is better than nothing. And even if they have to give up, some of their freedom and give up significant portions of their labor or the proceeds of the labor to militias. Now, the way international corporations come into play is like, because most of these regions are difficult to get to, there's no paved roads. A lot of these mines in eastern Congo are accessible only by footpaths, and the minerals are dug. It's like raw ore, and it's loaded up into sacks, and it's physically carried out of these locations on people's backs and along these footpaths. So the international corporations don't really come in contact with any of these minerals until they've actually been brought out of the bush or out of the jungles and then are collected in large warehouses. And at that point, people who are buyers will and who represent, they're like intermediaries between these where people that own these warehouses where these minerals are collected and then the international community, these buyers are quite often freelancers or self-employed, salespeople that function, they work for, percentages, and they will secure these minerals and then they're shipped out to, other locations where they're refined and eventually turned into usable metal products.
Oh, my. So Africa basically is just a big resource pit for anybody that wants to to go in and exploit them.
That's exactly right. It's a big wide open field, and you know, adding to the complexity of the adding to the problem is that the governments that do control, like you know, these resources, like, and I use the word control lightly. These governments themselves are corrupt, and they're very, very susceptible to bribery, especially from wealthy international corporations.
All righty, Peter. We're going to go to a break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. All righty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Peter Eichstadt. His websites are petereichstadt.com and petereichstadt.blogspot.com. And we were talking about the exploitation in Africa. And, of course, you have to look at these corporations and of course, the middlemen who collect a lot of commission, no doubt. Certainly people understand deep down that there's a lot of corruption there, and that Africans are being exploited. That the people in Africa ought to be able to benefit from the resources of their own country instead of having foreigners come in and drain them while they live in poverty and desperation.
Yeah, well, that's what one of my serious concerns about the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo is that they, you know, people don't realize that, you know, what a large and resource-rich place the Congo is. And it has, you know, as you know, some of the background, as you mentioned earlier, is that initially Europeans, King Leopold of Belgium, claimed the Congo, this is why it eventually became known as the Belgian Congo. But he didn't claim it as a colony of Belgium. He claimed it as his personal property, and that's the status it took. So he pretty much did what he wanted with the country and exploited minerals there, as well as rubber and an elephant tusks for ivory. And this kind of set the tone for the exploitation, you know, of the Congo, which has continued today. And the current government there is one of the most hopelessly corrupt governments in the world. And they've been running around making deals with, you know, corporations and companies in other countries for years. And the problem is that there's these large fees and things like that paid, you know, bonuses and agreements, you know, paid to the government by international companies and corporations. And unfortunately, a lot of this money disappears, and it goes into, supposedly goes into the government. But in fact, huge amounts are siphoned off into private bank accounts by the political leaders. And despite this, you know, vast amount of resources that exist in the Congo, which, you know, theoretically should make it one of the richest countries in the world, and is in fact, you know, one of the poorest, has no real functioning government, it has no functioning school system, and has no functioning healthcare systems. The eastern part of the country, which I focus a lot of my work on, is completely separated from the western part of the country, which is where the capital of Kinshasa is, by a jungle. And there's virtually no roads from one side
Amazing.
Of the country to the other.
Amazing. We are going to our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be back after a station ID and a word from our sponsors. So stay tuned. Be right back. Spingola Speaks. Our guest today is Peter Eichstadt. He is the author of, let's see, we got to count them, 5 books, going on 6, because you're working on another book about Mexico and the immigration issue.
Yeah, I've been traveling quite a bit along the U.S.-Mexico border, looking at how, you know, the increase in border enforcement and, has been affecting communities up and down the all along the border. And then also I'm looking at immigrant issues and the need for immigration reform. And it's been very interesting. I have a lot more to do.
Well, there's certainly a lot of interesting things going on along the border, and yeah. Have been for quite some time. And it does kind of, I think, contribute to the chaos in our own country. And I don't think that it's not deliberate. I think that it is very deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
What do you
well,
think?
Well, there's a lot of I mean, I'm looking into a lot of that right now. But my working title for my book is called The Frontier of Fear, and I think there's you know, from my perspective, I think there's been a lot of a lot of fear generated. As to what's happening along the border, that is essentially unwarranted.
Oh.
And my concern is that the, you know, we've had a long-standing relationship with Mexico. I mean, it goes back hundreds of years, and we had a relatively open border, and suddenly. You know, when 9/11 happened, you know, everything changed and the mentality changed because it was suddenly viewed instead of our neighbor having a neighbor, and we still have, you know, we do billions of dollars in trade a day with Mexico. And it's just like Canada, trade with Mexico is vital to our economy. And all of a sudden, you know, following 9/11, you know, the people who had been one of our largest trading partners were suddenly viewed as the enemy. And so, you know, and it's spilled over into immigration, et cetera, et cetera. And it, another one of the interesting aspects of, that I've come across, you know, my research is that, you know, I've interviewed a large number of, you know, migrants coming across undocumented workers, as they're called now, but they're undocumented people coming across. And they, you know, the reason they come across the border is for economic opportunity. And why, you know, if it didn't exist here, if they weren't being hired, they wouldn't come.
Right. So, and, of course, the international banking establishment ruined their peso, ruined the value of their peso in 1996, and destroyed their opportunities there.
Yeah, it's you know, there's a lot of, you know, the, you know, that's a whole you know, very important issue, is like, you know, the status of the Mexican economy, and then the troubles that they've had, and then another aspect, of course, this which we're all familiar with, is the drug cartels, which have created such chaos and you know, in an astronomical death toll in Mexico, which is one of the driving factors also, is that propels people to get out. You know, they want to get away from the violence.
Right. So, who would want to live in amidst violence?
Exactly.
Peter, we do have a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back, and we will take calls at 800-313-9443. Be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Peter Eichstadt. His websites are petereichstadt.com and petereichstadt.blogspot.com. And you were talking about the situation with the Mexicans coming north for economic opportunity because of the situation in their country, which might be a good segue to talk about if you poison us, mm-hmm. because these people, the Navajo Nation, Also, we're seeking some sort of opportunity, but it kind of backfired, and I'm afraid that that some of the Mexican nationals who are coming north may also find themselves in the same situation where they're really exposed to some dangers because they will work in industry that perhaps Americans won't work in, and I hate to use that phrase, but I think that they will do things for less money and no benefits and no insurance and no safety regulations.
Yeah, that's one of the problems with the situation, I think, as it exists now, is that, especially with, I'll talk about the Native American situation here in a minute, but, the situation we have now is that the, lots of, many, many employers in the U.S. are more than willing to hire illegal aliens. And the reason is, of course, that they will work in dangerous situations, and they will work for very repressed wage levels. And so economically, the U.S. is taking advantage of or in reaping the benefits of this cheap labor. And a lot of people don't like to acknowledge that fact. Another financial aspect of this, which amounts to billions of dollars, is that a lot of these illegal workers are paying taxes, which are taken out of their paychecks before they're cashed, of course. And this money is going into government to at all different levels, including Social Security, and it's never being claimed by these people. So there's a lot of hidden little effects of this. But the problem, I think, is with a lot of these people is that they are working in at low wage jobs. They're afraid to go to healthcare facilities because they might be arrested. So it's a very, very difficult situation, and I think in a lot of respects it's obviously not fair to these people, especially if they are being employed, which all of them are, by legitimate businesses in the U.S. And I think employers have to bear some of the responsibility for this. And I think ultimately American consumers have to wake up to this fact that they're benefiting. The fact that we can buy cheap vegetables that are grown in the U.S. is because they're being picked by the people that will accept very low wages to do so. If Americans were going to be picking vegetables, they would want at least minimum wage, but they would probably want double that.
Right.
So,
but we've had, I grew up in California, and California was, a lot of people, a lot of farmers did hire Mexican laborers. They would come for just the harvesting season and then go back. They wouldn't come in and live here and take up residence and exploit the system. So it isn't that this has not been happening for some time in agriculture, but now it is happening in other industry also.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point you're making because, and that's an interesting situation because in the past, it was possible for people to come into Mexico on the guest worker visa programs. But now with the hardening of the border, people are, since they know, we've limited the number of visas and access into the country, it's much, much more difficult to do this, that there are a lot of these migrants have come in and they're staying. Because they know if they go back, they'll never be able to return again, and that's why I'm suggesting that we need to modify and relax our visa system, so that we can have a functioning guest worker program to allow people to come in and do the work and then return. So they're not doing exactly what like you were suggesting, which is taking advantage of the social systems, which are expensive. Most of the migrants that I've talked to who are either planning to come across or had been in the U.S. and returned and were going to return illegally were doing so simply because they felt like they really had no other choice, and they preferred, if possible, to just come and work and then go back. They didn't want to stay in the U.S., but because the hardening of the laws and the hardening of the border, tightening of the border, which is appropriate. I'm not saying we shouldn't have a strict border, but you know that we need to have a system that allows people to come back and forth and do the work, so they can take it, you know, they can reap the benefits, and the U.S. can reap the benefits as well without costing both sides so much money.
Sure. But when you couple that with outsourcing of production and then insourcing of other labor from other places such as India and the Philippines and so many other places, then it seems like we take all of our anger out on our closest neighbor, you know, Mexico, when in fact it's more than just the Mexicans that are coming in.
Yeah, the whole thing is it's a very crazy situation. I agree with that. It's we should have I think Americans need to be a little bit more motivated to take on some of these jobs. I mean, the reason, you know, like we're bringing in engineers from India is because our schools are failing, and they're failing to produce the number of engineers and scientists that we need. And so in order to keep the American economy strong, we're turning to foreign countries, you know, when in fact these positions should be filled by Americans. And there's no easy answer to that situation either, but I think I agree with what you were saying. There's no sense in us taking it out, our frustrations, which are legitimate, taking them out on people that are only trying to, earn a decent wage, you know, in a day. And then, people from Mexico, just want to, make a living wage and then be able to go back and enjoy it and spend time with their families in Mexico and then
sure.
Return when it's necessary.
But, of course, I think there's also a multicultural agenda that is driving this, as well as when you look at the cost of going to school now, which are just tremendous, mm-hmm. And include a long-term debt for people who want to go to school. I think there are a lot of different factors that are involved in this, and not just, the Americans just aren't going to school and just aren't earning the degrees. So I think there's other things going on. But we do have some callers lining up, so why don't we take a call?
Okay.
All right, Chuck, Texas, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Or good afternoon. I have a question for your guest. Can you cite the tightening of the borders for me? Because all I see is us backing off our border checkpoints have been moved back 10 miles into Texas just to harass American citizens. It has nothing to do with protecting the border. Whole areas had just been put wide open. They put signs out, danger, don't go here. Where's this tightening of the borders you're talking about? Where's your evidence of that?
Well, I've spent for some people, you know, if we had a solid steel fence going from the Gulf of Mexico all the way to San Diego, that would keep people happy. But I think the fact is we don't need a sealed border. We need a flexible border that allows, like I was saying before, mentioning earlier, is like we do, well, you know, several billion dollars a day in trade with Mexico, and we can't simply just shut all that off because a few people are coming across illegally.
Wait a minute. There's legal checkpoints to cross with legal products, okay? No
right.
Nation can exist without secure borders. If you don't have a border, you don't have a secure nation.
Right.
I'm just asking you to demonstrate to me the tightening of the borders you keep talking about. I don't see it.
Well, I actually just got back last week from spending a whole week with the Border Patrol in Nogales, and I spend a day on the border with all the various border patrol agents, and I watch them go through cars. I spend time with them as they check passports. I went in with them when all of the people that raised any kind of red flags were, brought into secure facilities, and their papers and their stories and everything were checked. If they were crossing illegally, they were sent back across the border. The next several days, I spent traveling up and down the border in these remote regions with Border Patrol agents, and I accompanied them on one night where we were able to track
gentlemen,
apprehend 17 illegal aliens.
Gentlemen, we do have to go to a break. Chuck, you're welcome to stay on over the break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Today is Peter Eichstadt. His websites are petereichstadt.com and petereichstadt.blogspot.com. And back on March 23rd, 2005, George W. Bush, Vincente Fox, and Prime Minister Paul Martin from Canada met at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. And as I said, this was on March 23rd, 2005. And they established the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. And in my personal opinion, the border has been pretty much wide open ever since. And we now have a de facto union that includes Canada, the United States, and Mexico. And I don't think they're trying to secure the border at all. That's just my opinion. What do you think, Peter? Does that have merit?
I don't know. Like your previous caller indicated, there's a lot of people are frustrated about, the border and it's not completely sealed down tight. And what you were mentioning there is kind of like a point along a long continuum in which the border has really never been secured there's still places, there's very few and far between now, but there's still places along the border where there's nothing but a barbed wire fence. And
that's totally untrue.
Okay, Chuck, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, there's large areas that are totally, you rode with them and caught 17 illegals in one night. Estimates of how many cross our borders each night is in the thousands. And because you caught 17 when you were out riding around with a few guys, that's not security. Let me see, the GAO this last year reported themselves that $573 million were cut from border security in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's not securing anything. Now, if I were a Mexican, sure, I would come over here as well. But we can't be feeding them, caring for them, fleeing their country until they tank us, which is why some of them are now going back, because they almost have. And I say they. There's a lot of things contributing to this. But nobody can say that border security has ever been anything but a joke, will continue to be a joke. Where are the border checkpoints now? They're 10 miles within Texas. And they pull Americans, stop American citizens driving down the highway, and, are you a citizen? Can I search your car? It has nothing to do with border security. It's turned into a dog and pony show just to train the American people. So don't tell me that security on the border has been increased. It has not.
Chuck, where in Texas do you live?
I live in Fort Worth.
Okay.
But we're real concerned all over Texas because, I mean, it's just ranchers can't even make a living anymore. They're having to abandon their ranches. It's dangerous to live down there. They can't defend themselves. The minute they do, they get charged. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just absolutely ridiculous for someone to make the claim that we're making any attempts whatsoever to secure the borders. That's just ludicrous.
Well, I mean, the facts are, the facts speak for themselves. You know, I mean, if you've ever been to the border, you've seen what's going on there. You've seen the fences. You know, there's major sections of, you know, the border of Arizona are, you know, lined with these 20-foot high steel fences. And the areas where some of the areas where I've been, and most of the areas are also protected by, you know, towers, and some of these are mobile towers, which have 24-hour surveillance. They're video during the day and then infrared and radar at night. And they're also patrolled by fixed-wing aircraft that have the same capabilities. They're patrolled by helicopters that have the same capability. I mean, it's not perfect, obviously, and you have to keep in mind as to where the, you know, what kind of situation was along or has been along the border for hundreds of years, which is that there was virtually nothing along the border.
Gentlemen, could this be the situation that both of you are perhaps blindfolded and touching the elephant in a different place? You're both right in certain respects, and I wonder, is that fence to keep Americans in or to keep the Mexicans out?
Good question. Well, I tell you what, you're having a great show, and I love a little bit of controversy once in a while. Good show, keeps people listening.
That's good.
Bye-bye now.
Thanks, all right. Chuck. All righty, we have another caller. Let's take Joel in Wisconsin, and we are about to go into a break, so we'll hear your first comments. Joel?
Okay, I'll be kind of brief. Your guest reeks for government.
Oh, no. We're not going to be rude, Joel.
I can be rude. I'm the caller.
No, I don't. I think not. The guest has given his time to come on the program, and I think that he deserves respect, okay? We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Alrighty, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Peter Eichstadt. And a couple of comments from the chat room. Let's see. Undocumented Mexicans have more rights here than U.S. citizens. Someone else said, those aren't fences on the borders, they're ladders.
Ladders. No, those are good comments. Let's see. The last one first. I had, if you go to the, if people want, you can track down a photo that surfaced a couple of weeks ago, I think it was 3 weeks ago, where it was just it was on the western border of the western side of the southern border of Arizona, where it had one of these. The government had built one of those large 20-high-foot fences I was telling you about, steel with concrete-filled posts, and they're buried pretty deep in the ground. Anyway, the drug cartel people had put a ramp, thrown a ramp that went all the way up over the wall and then a ramp down the side, and it was a metal folding ramp. And they tried to drive a Jeep Cherokee over the top of it, but it got hung up at the very peak because the ramp was too steep. Anyway, so the picture was of this a Jeep Cherokee filled with drugs teetering on the top of this fence. So it, when they talk about it, it's a ladder, it's not a fence. I think that's in more respects than one, that's true.
Exactly.
And I know there are cases, and you know, there are incidents and pictures, and I've talked to people who have Border Patrol agents who have had gun exchanges with people who climb up these fences and then perch themselves on top, and some of these guys have been shot dead, and unfortunately this generates this huge hue and cry about people coming across and being unwarranted killed for what they're trying to do. So you know.
And we also have Border Patrol agents who have been killed and who have not the cases have not been resolved. Families are very upset. And I believe that if the U.S. government really, really wanted to halt the drug trade, they would do that. But, in fact, there are people in the U.S. government who actually benefit from the drug trade. And I can definitely see what Chuck was talking about with the cattle ranchers down there. There's been numerous stories about people being sued because they were protecting their property, which is our right to do. And when you couple that with the ranchers in Colorado and elsewhere, that the government and the military are trying to run off their land, you kind of wonder what's going on. Mm-hmm. If they're trying to get rid of all the ranchers in the country or what? Because we do know that factory farming and factory ranching, makes it very difficult for the independents to stay in business. And if you have all the chaos at the border, that certainly contributes to it.
Well, my experience has been that the vast majority of ranchers, of course, feel themselves under assault, and then they know this land better than anybody. But on the other hand, they also are, the vast majority of them are very willing to work with the Border Patrol and other law enforcement to, take care of things and then improve the safety and secure their land, because a lot of them do feel that they're under attack. But like I said, most of them are, anxious to work, within the bounds of the law with the Border Patrol and other law enforcement agencies. And I think a lot of them would prefer to have a peaceful situation rather than taking the, law into their own hands. I did spend some time with people like Glenn Spencer, who's become kind of a lightning rod of controversy, and he has this organization, as you may be familiar with, called American Border Patrol, and he and a number of other people have been, agitating on behalf of increased enforcement. And I visited his property, and he spent a day with him, actually, and he was pointing out kind of the ludicrousness of this, the way we've gone about securing the border. And he has about 100 acres, and I think about 20 miles or I mean 20 or 25 acres or so frontage property on the border. And the one of these large, 20-foot high steel fences goes across most of the bottom of his property there, but then when it gets to a river, it ends. And that's exactly what the migrants use coming across.
Sure.
They cross right up the riverbank, and he sits there at night and watches them. So, there's a lot of, there's a lot to be said for, the good argument to be made is that the border, in fact, isn't secure.
Right.
But like I said, compared to the way it's been for hundreds of years, where there was virtually no demarcation of the border, we've come a long way.
Right. All righty. Let's take another caller. Let's take Richard in Washington. Richard, welcome to the program.
Good morning. As you know, Dee, and I have an unusual take on reality, and I try to look at things objectively. My take on the whole thing is, the prison, the open-air prison, is in effect. And these illegals, quote-unquote, that are coming across the border are the only true Americans left. They are sovereigns. They are the founding fathers' people that gave rights to people that would want to secure their freedom.
Now, who are you calling sovereigns?
I'm not really sure what you're saying.
Yeah, who are you calling sovereigns, Richard?
The illegals. That's why they have a free pass with the police and the court system and the Social Security system, et cetera, even though their wages are kind of taken away from them by way of the taxation. They come over here to work for a wage or to live here for a wage, and they do that with complete freedom. They are independent because they haven't bought into the system and given up their rights. Thus, in the Americas, they are the last of the true Americans.
Okay, but what about those that come over here and get a Social Security card and become part of the system?
Evidently, they want to be slaves like the rest of us.
Indeed.
Really?
All righty. Well, appreciate
an interesting take on it.
Well, you can read Why Nations Fail, and you can find out that the Spanish essentially made us all slaves initially, except for some of North America. And when the English colonies got bigger, essentially the only thing that was left that the Spanish hadn't plundered was parts of the east of North America and some of the uncharted lands of the Louisiana Purchase, and then the English came to plunder them. I mean, it's all like the parables of tribes explain. Organization that the governments exert on the slaves, and we all seem to want to be slaves, for power, prosperity, and to take advantage of the labor of the people.
Yes, indeed. All righty, Richard, thank you for your phone call.
All right, take care.
Uh-huh. Peter, do you have any comments?
Well, it's an interesting thought. I mean, I hadn't really looked at migrants like that, but, I mean, he makes a good point. I said that people coming across are definitely their independent entities. And
he may have something there. He's very astute.
A lot of them... A lot of them do secure. I mean, they've shown me. I mean, I've talked with a lot of undocumented people here, and they've shown me their Social Security cards. And there's a thriving business in getting
fake ones that they can get a job, but they don't have to pay into the system.
Yeah, and that's like I say though. I think there's been almost an exclusionary focus on the people that are coming across to do the jobs, and I don't think there's been enough focus on who's actually hiring these people. You know, like these are American business people who are providing jobs, and a lot of them will claim that they don't know the people are illegal, but it's not true. You know, you can go into almost any restaurant anywhere in the U.S., and you go into the kitchen, you're going to find people from Mexico working there.
Right.
And, these employers have to bear some responsibility for the situation.
Sure. I agree with you. Another comment from the chat room. Fences keep people in, guns keep them out. All righty. Let's take E.T. in Nebraska. E.T., welcome to the program.
Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Yeah.
Yes.
Listening to you before, you were talking about gangs. And then you went to corporations, and hey, what's the difference? I mean, between the gang and a corporation, pretty much the same thing. It's like you're talking about the same thing. You got a corporation that they create this. They have some limited liability corporation, a bunch of people. They decide to call themselves ABC Corporation when they engage in criminal activity, and then they can just blame it on this fictitious entity called a corporation. And
Good point.
So what you're saying is that there's no difference between what and a corporation?
Gangs.
Banks. Oh.
Gangs.
Gangs. Gangs. Okay.
Gangs.
Well, no, that's a good point. I mean, I understand what you're saying. And but as you know, the reason... the legal situation was created for limited liability corporations is so people wouldn't be sued personally for whatever involvement they had in corporate activity that may be deemed illegal, and it would be anyway. That's part of our society is. And the business world has created these rules, so it's the kind of thing that we have to live with.
And it's those business people that are hiring these illegals, though.
So. Yeah, and that's what they...
And they get away with it.
Allows a lot of people to, escape out the back door without being held accountable for what they're doing. It's an unfortunate fact of life, but you know, a lot of people wouldn't risk forming a business, wouldn't risk forming a legitimate business if they and taking some risks, be they business or otherwise, if they knew that they were going to be subject to, you know, such high levels of liability. So it's on the one hand, I think these limited liability rules for both small and large entities help stimulate the economy. I mean, I think that's the reality. But on the other hand, it does allow a lot of people to escape shirk responsibility.
All right.
You know, a case in point, which I was just aghast at yesterday, that was announced with Toyota Motor Corporation. Agreed to a $1 billion settlement with owners of the Toyota Corollas and other cars that had been victims of this unexpected acceleration. And yet they did so without admitting any liability, admitted any wrongdoing. It was part of the agreement, you know, and it left me puzzled. I was like, how can a corporation come to a settlement with its customers over a lawsuit over a defective product and settle for more than $1 million and then turn around and say it's not our fault? You know, I mean, I don't understand that. But
Well, that's kind of the way the politicians work too. They act like they're so inefficient, but then they claim, oh, gosh, we just didn't realize, didn't know.
Yeah, we didn't.
Okay, thank you, E.T., for your phone call. All righty. So let's talk a little bit about If You Poison Us.
Okay, yeah, we didn't get a chance to talk about that. I was, since we're on the theme of large corporations and government and that, I was working as a reporter in New Mexico, and the government was opening up a large radioactive waste site in the southern part of the state. And I got very involved in looking into radioactive waste issues, and that very quickly led me into a situation that I became aware of on the Navajo Reservation, which is the largest Indian reservation in the country. And what I found out was that there's been this huge amount of uranium had been mined off of the Navajo Reservation for use in building up America's nuclear weapons arsenal. And unfortunately, a lot of the Navajo uranium miners, once the Cold War kind of quieted down a little bit, a lot of the Navajo uranium miners came down with lung cancer. And it became almost an epidemic situation there on the mine, on the reservation, and resulted in a tremendous number of deaths among the miners there. And I found out that, health officials knew of the danger that was going on, knew of the potential loss of life that unregulated uranium mining was could cause, and however, they did nothing to prevent it. And there were a number of lawsuits, one filed against the corporations that were doing the mining there and another against the government. And
which corporations were involved?
Kerr McGee was the big one, and both of these lawsuits were eventually thrown out. And
really?
But, you know, what the problem is that with this story, I mean, even though I wrote this book in 1994, we're going on almost 20 years ago, the situation on the reservation really hasn't improved. All of the radioactive waste materials that were scattered around at the time are still there on the reservation, and there are significant portions of the reservation where the groundwater has been contaminated and is undrinkable. and it has to be piped in from clean sources, you know, miles and miles and miles.
All righty, we are going to our last break. We'll be back for our last segment, so stay tuned. Be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today has been Peter Eichstadt. His websites are petereichstadt.com and petereichstadt.blogspot.com. And you were talking about the horrible situation on the Navajo Reservation. We do have one last caller. Let's quickly take her, Marla in Oregon, and then we'll get back to that topic. Marla, quickly.
Yes, you were talking about the Mexican situation and the field workers who came in to pick our vegetables. We had a wonderful program going. It was called the Bracero Program, and it worked fabulously. I don't know which politician is responsible for discontinuing that program, but it was fine. And I speak as a small business person who was run out of business. I was stolen out of business because of the Mexicans that I hired. I gave them an opportunity, and they slapped me in the face. And when they come into your... Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
When they come into your business and want to shop, there'll be mama in about... 8 to 10 children along. Yes, they'll buy things, but they're surveilling that business, and they will have somebody come back later on, maybe the same night or later on, and they will take from your business, and you won't be able to support your business with all of that going on.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Marla.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that also.
Well, that's the truth, and I want to know why. You haven't gone down to see Mr. Glenn Spencer down on the border. He can give you the real issues that are going on.
He did. Yeah, he worked with him.
I did visit him.
Well, he's the most wonderful person that I can think of. But how long did you stay there?
I was there most of the day.
And he approves of the way the federal government is handling the border?
Well, no, he's probably he's kind of a front man for, or a point man for the critics of the way the government's handling it. And, you know, there's a lot of legitimate complaints about what's being done, that it's not being done well enough. And I'm not trying to make an apology or support the government in any way, shape, or form. I'm saying that compared to the way things were like a decade ago, we've come a long way. And I think a lot of people, you know, like you were saying, there was the Bracero program, which allowed, you know, people to come up from Mexico and work for a while and then go back. I think that kind of program has to be resurrected, because now, like what I was trying to say before, is that with the border, you know, being tightened, more Mexicans are staying here longer periods of time illegally, and because they're forced to live underground, because they have no choice, they quite often do turn to crime, and I think... I'm very sympathetic with the situation that you're describing.
Right.
There's a difference between being generous and being stupid. And believe me, I have no more generosity for those people ever since I was treated in such a way, because it broke me.
Right. Okay. All righty. Peter is coming back in another couple of weeks, I think. We have you on the schedule. Okay. Marla, thank you for sharing your experience. And there are so many factors involved, and we'll talk about that the next time you're here. So thank you so much, Peter.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you tomorrow. Oh,
with finance.